Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. This episode is from the Momentum Series, resurfacing the most popular episodes from our archives to shine a light on the continued growth of companies in our network. And now, on to the show.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of FinStrat Management. And today I'm super excited. We have with us Scott Garber, managing partner of Early Light Ventures. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So with that, dive right into it. We could start with a bit of background on yourself. We'd love to hear how your journey led you to starting in your own venture capital fund.
Yeah, it's a bit of an unorthodox background. I founded one company in college, ended up doing okay with that. Founded a second one right out of college, did not do okay with that, but learned a ton from it. Ended up interning at an intelligence agency, got the full scope clearance, Lifestyle Poly. Didn't think I'd end up going back, even though I had a good experience and did go back. Did all sorts of different things within that agency from basically every directorate. Got involved in operations, got involved in essentially everything that agency does. Ended up meeting a really lucky break meeting a pretty prolific angel investor who had a similar background, a more impressive but similar background to myself. And after 3 years of getting dinners and lunches with him, learned how to angel invest, or at least had the basis of angel investing. And after 3 years of me constantly asking him, should I do this? Got what looked like a green light. And we said, yeah, you should do this. And ended up angel investing in 2013. Went to a company called Serco, where I helped run M&A and corporate strategy for a couple of years. Went to AARP as an EIR, kept angel investing on nights and weekends because I really loved doing it. And then eventually had the opportunity to run Baltimore Angels, where I ended up finding the first 15 or 20 LPs in Fund 1. This is 2019. And that was Fund 1 of Early Light Ventures. Now we're on Fund 2.
So with that, you have an opportunity for over a decade to form your opinion and an approach to investing. And so how would you describe it? And how do you think about investing in this current landscape?
It's as unorthodox as my own background. It's definitely different. It's not completely different. There's no one doing what I'm doing, but it's a little bit off the radar. So what I'm prioritizing is what a lot of other funds avoid, which is I'm going after first-time founders primarily. I'm going after second-tier cities. And by second-tier city, I mean like Atlanta, DC, Baltimore, Richmond, Minneapolis, Detroit, Chicago. I'm not talking LA or San Diego. I actually like San Diego. I'm not talking LA or the Valley or New York for the most part, or Boston. So I'm hunting where others really aren't hunting or don't want to hunt or can't hunt. And the idea behind the thesis is I'm backing those really hungry, chip on their shoulder, something to prove founders. And I'm getting in relatively early, although Fund 2 is a little bit later than Fund 1. And actually Fund 1 is even later than my angel investing, but generally pre-seed or seed. Fund 2 is more like an A or B fund, although it can go back and forth. The basis though, between all of the investments that I've done in the past and in the future is I need to see a really hungry founder that really has like legitimately something to prove. And you can see it. They really have that push to run through a brick wall, over the brick wall, whatever they have to do to get to the finish line. And they're willing to sacrifice whatever they have to sacrifice to get there. And it's that real hunger that you can't coach. Good.
And so I'd be curious your perspective. Do you find that mentality is unique amongst first-time founders?
There are second-time founders that have it. And I actually recently backed a second-time founder that had that same tenacity. I think it's a little bit different when you've had a successful exit. You obviously know the playbook, and a lot of the people you're going to hire, probably the first people you're going to sell to, how to raise money, how to do a lot of what you need to do as a second or third or fourth time founder. And that's really attractive to a lot of venture funds, is the playbook to execute it. You just go on the field and just do what you did before. And there is the tenacity and hunger of some of those founders. But I think with a first time founder, especially one that went to a second tier school, like a good school, but not a great school, and someone that's in a second tier city, there's that. It's hard to explain. There's that chip on their shoulder. There's that aggressiveness, the pugnaciousness. They really want to prove it. They want to prove that they can do this. And this is their one chance to do it. They can't just fail and go raise another big venture round in a new company and just start over. This is the opportunity. And you can see it, you can feel it. And they really have that pressure to sell, and they love selling. And it's hard to replicate that.
And so let's build on that. So I heard that you're looking at second tier cities. Is it safe to say, though, that this opportunity to get perhaps a better valuation for the fund exists not only because you're going to places where other investors aren't, but because maybe a second-time founder is going to result in a higher valuation, given that they have a track record?
That is part of it. And if someone's had a successful exit and they're especially in a bigger city, bigger meaning at like Silicon Valley or New York or maybe Boston, it's a lot easier to go to people you already know and say, hey, I've sold my last company. I made you money. Here's the valuation. Here are the terms. Here's what I'm raising. And the VCs are like, okay, because they can't really push back. And I'm not trying to get like a crazy deal. I'm not trying to screw over a founder. It's just, I need to make money for my LPs, my investors. That's my mission. And as a founder, your mission is to go have a good exit and make money for yourself and your employees and everyone working for you. And for your clients, you want your clients to have a good exit too, in terms of good piece of software, very useful, good ROI, happy they did it. Everything's aligned. And I don't see that alignment necessarily, especially right now, pre-seed and seed. The valuations are just, there's a lot of misalignment happening.
And so you bring up a really good point. And it's this idea that I don't, and I see it as a theme, but this idea that founders don't necessarily appreciate that investors like yourself have your own investors.
Yeah.
And that you have a responsibility to make sure that you're deploying the fund's capital intelligently. If you were to use this opportunity, what would you say to the founders out there to help them appreciate your perspective when it comes to valuation?
So I think every fund is different. They all have different goals. They have different portfolio construction, meaning the number of winners, the losers, the multiples they need, the time to exit, all the different things around that. So the risk reward is going to be a little bit different for every venture fund. I'd ask every GP or every general partner you talk to, what is your goal within the fund? What are you looking for? When do you need the exits? What kind of exits are you looking for? What have your past portfolios looked like? What have your past relationships with founders looked like? If you're on a board, what has that been like? Just to get an idea of what they need, because that's going to influence what they need out of you. Because there's some venture funds like, yeah, shoot for the moon. I don't care. Burn a bunch of money. If you fail, I don't give a crap. If you have a huge outcome, that's great for me. I'm basically the opposite, where I want to have a good outcome in almost every investment I make. I have to, because I'm not shooting for 100x, 200x, 500x outcomes. I'm shooting for, in some cases, 2 or 3x outcomes, but in a lot of cases, 4, 5, 6, 8, 10x type outcomes, usually on the mid end of that. And if some fall short, which some do, great. If some go bigger, great. That's the way I aim. So it's a little bit different aim depending on who you're pitching to.
I think you bring up a really good point. Effectively, what you're describing is portfolio management. You have capital, you deploy it. Are you making more precise bets or the proverbial spray and pray? And depending on the approach that you take is also going to dictate what types of returns that you're looking for. And so it makes me think of another topic that I think is really valuable for founders to be thinking about is, but I'll ask you, is how often do you find when someone is coming to raise capital for you, do they actually say, hey, this is what where my head is. I'm looking for a double or I'm looking for a home run?
Not out of the gate. I don't know that I think a lot of founders are realizing that if they come pitch me and they do diligence or they do their own research, like I can read their body language. Generally, I'd say every time, is I can't read everyone's body language accurately every time. It's not possible. I can generally read what they're thinking though. Not all the time, but most of the time. So based on how they're giving me answers or what they're talking about or where they lead the discussion, I can tell where they're aiming or what they're trying to do. And at the end of some of the conversations, I'll literally be like, here's what the outcome you want, right? And it depends on what they'll do. And sometimes, no, I'm going for a bigger outcome because I think they're conditioned to speak to most VCs who need a really big outcome. And I'll go, no, like, I don't need that outcome. Here's the outcome I think you're going to be at. And I'll see where they say based on that.
Said another way, for the founders who are listening, there's just tremendous value in being forthright with what you're aiming for.
Yeah, in some cases, it actually benefits founders to not be forthright because they don't know where the company's going to go. And to raise money, if a founder goes out and says, hey, I'm shooting for a $30 to $50, $60 million exit because of a lot of reasons. I can get everyone that believed in me early on is going to make money, including all the early employees that I had. The clients will have a good outcome because they'll have a good home and the software's going to be well-maintained and they're not going to get price gouged when they get acquired. And my own family and my co-founders are going to have really good outcomes and we're going to be able to retire if we want to retire or start another company or do whatever. And if you pitch that to a lot of VCs and they go, yeah, I really applaud that and I appreciate that and I get that. And a lot of them do get that, but that doesn't fit me. I need a bigger outcome. So in some ways they can shoot yourself in the foot. So I get where they're coming from. And in some cases they don't actually know where they're aiming because they don't know where the company's going to go and they don't know how fast it's going to grow or where it could be.
So with that, one of the things you mentioned early on is looking for founders with grit. Do you also find, though, that the founders who have the tenacity, sometimes maybe their hubris prevents them from being or admitting that, they know, hey, there's an element of this that I don't know?
Sometimes. I think so. There's good, there's great, and there's not as good founders. And that's definitely the case in every type of risk or reward or aim or whatever they're doing. Yeah, it definitely happens. There's situations too where they'll get an exit offer and it's maybe not the best offer, but it's a good offer. And some founders will say, okay, I'm going to try to negotiate this or make this work. And some will just say, not even entertaining it. And some of the best outcomes that I've had within my portfolio are founders that are like, you know what, the offer is not great, but it's within the bottom end of my range. And since I'm in an opportunistic position, I can come back to them and negotiate and just be like, here's what I need. Like, take it or leave it. And a lot of these companies have some leverage because they don't need a big exit. And sometimes those companies can go back to their boards or the decision makers and they come back with a better offer or an offer that fits. And that's happened. So there are certainly offers you just ignore because they're just predatory and terrible. But there's some offers that are lower, but not horrible. And you can sometimes get them where you want it to be.
And so with that, I'd love to dive into some of your experience working with individual portfolio companies. Before we get off investment strategy, though, I'd love to hear whether or not anything in particular you're bullish on at the moment.
Like sector or stage or?
Sector. Let's start with sector.
So a lot of VCs are going to talk about AI, like pure AI solutions, which some VCs are positioned to do really well in. A lot of VCs are not. And I think a lot of what's going to happen and what is happening now is a lot of them are just chasing. Because one, their LPs are asking, what are you doing in AI? And they have to show something for that. And if they miss all these AI companies and it actually is a really big boom, they can't raise another fund or the story gets really hard for them. Some VCs are saying, I'm not even going to touch this. It's a 50-foot pole because I don't know what I'm getting. The valuations are stupid and there's no revenue. And this is probably still ahead of its time. I'm in that camp where I believe in AI. It's not Web3 where I don't believe in it at all. It's just a gimmick to some extent. Which is what I thought in Fund 1, which is why there's no Web3 companies in there. And it's why I've never invested in any Web3 companies. Certainly money to be made. And there are some investors in my first fund and second fund that did extraordinarily well by investing in cryptocurrencies since they're just really good at it and they had great timing. But as a fund, I wouldn't touch it. Same with AI, pure AI solutions. Because if I'm seeing a pure AI deal and it's a really good deal, it's probably not a good deal. Some of the offshoots are good deals. And I've got some in the portfolio. Cyber is one area I've always loved and I want to do more than that. I paused because valuations were just absurd for a little while. They're coming a little bit back to earth. Health tech, I do a lot of non-clinical health tech, although I'm a little more skittish around just because of sales cycles and what's potentially going to happen with the election, although who knows. And then fintech, which I was pretty bearish on, which I'm actually a little less bearish on because there's a lot less people investing in it now. And I think there's actually still money in it.
And so with that, one of the things that I infer is you obviously know your space, you have very strong opinions, not only what to invest, but how to invest. What's your experience been with managing LP expectations?
It's difficult. I have about 140 individual LPs between the two different funds. So there's a lot of personalities and there's a lot of different conversations and things that are being had. I think over-communicating is a big thing. I try to over-communicate. So I'll send a newsletter at a minimum every quarter, sometimes more. And the last one I sent was extremely detailed down to the portfolio company where it's at right now, where I think it's going to be the narrative around it. This is in both funds. I think LPs appreciate that, just to have that in the back pocket. Some of them read it. Some of them maybe will read it. Some of them like having it, even if they don't read it. I think a lot of funds don't necessarily communicate with LPs. It's like founders that send updates like every 6 months or a year, or even less. It wears on investors where they don't trust you as much. And they wonder like what's happening. And then they get an update and it's either really good. And they're like, okay, great. But I wish I had more updates. Or it's really bad. And they're like, why didn't you communicate with me? So I think over-communication is one thing a lot of funds should do.
And do you think that applies for founders as well?
Oh yeah, no, I tell founders all the time. You want to give me a monthly update? Great. I love it. Like it's actually better. I have a better tab on what's happening. I can help you. If I can help you, I can get out of your way. If I can get out of your way, it takes half an hour, 2 hours at most every quarter or every month. Like it doesn't hurt. Use the same template. Just give me the numbers and tell me what happened.
And with that, no obligation, zero obligation to name any portfolio companies, but we'd love to hear if any are top of mind as to who are just great example of doing things well or challenges that they've overcome that you can share with us.
I'm not gonna name specific ones because it's like children. I'm not gonna name a favorite child or especially communication or anything like that. There are some that send me monthly updates. And again, there may be like two or three paragraphs. I love that though, because I know what's happening in the company. I can help them. I'll call them if I can. I have some founders that won't send updates, but call me every like week or two, which can be good, can be bad. Usually good though. It's just like with a lot of my investors, it's better to communicate good and bad news. And if it's bad news, it's better that I know it. Because if I get an update 6 months from now and it's really bad news and something could have been prevented to stop that, or they made a weird decision around like they took factoring money or they took a really bad loan or whatever it is with covenants. Like if they've already taken that, I can't help them. If they're thinking about taking that, I can help them.
And see, you bring up a really good point. for the founders who are listening to this, do you think it's fair to say investors are, or investors appreciate that there will be bad news?
I think most good ones do.
Founders who are listening to this, my sense is that's very sage advice or insight, and in that it's not going to be a bed of roses. And being able to talk about the good and the bad is extremely valuable. With that, you mentioned about getting on our calls or connecting with your founders. How do you think about providing support to them as one of their investors?
It'll vary. Some founders want different kinds and levels of support than others. Some want a ton of it. Some really don't want any. A lot of the second and third time founders don't need as much versus first time. I think one thing I do want to help, one thing I think a lot of founders don't quite realize, which I try to explain, but I'm not good at it probably, is that most general partners of funds have portfolios of companies that could be across multiple funds. They could have angel investments. They could have all sorts of other stuff happening. You're one of maybe 40 or 50 or 60 or who knows how many companies in their portfolio. And some take very little time, some take a lot of time. So there is a certain level that you can help, and there's a certain level you can't help. And there's some industries that I don't know a lot of people, and I've invested and I've told the founders usually straight up, I don't really know that many people. Like, I can be helpful from a financing standpoint, like telling you what to do or what I think is the right thing to do or around M&A. But like in terms of customer introductions or hires, like, I'm not going to help anyone because I can't. I'm a generalist. I invest in so many sectors. I can't know everyone everywhere. So that's one thing I would ask too, if founders are out pitching and they're going to get the answers of, oh yeah, I know a lot of people, and I'd ask who specifically. And if someone doesn't know everyone, it's not the worst thing in the world. It's sometimes good to have outside advice, and sometimes good to just take what I would call good money, good quality money. Someone that's going to put money in, knows when to help you, and also knows when just to get the hell out of your way.
The door swings both ways. I think for a kudos to you for saying that, hey, I know where my expertise lies, but I also know where it doesn't lie. With that, though, I'd be curious to hear over the years whether or not you see or have seen a common mistake that many founders make and what they can do to avoid these pitfalls.
Oh, there's a couple. The first one, which is usually a fatal one, is usually burn rate is one thing that I know founders pay attention to and the board makes them pay attention to, because that's your runway and that's how much sort of time you have to get the plane off the ground. And if you can't get it off the ground, then obviously you can't go and fly or do anything. I see some founders that are a little bit too skittish around spending. I see some founders that are way too liberal about it, and some that listen to their boards and some that don't. And I have some boards that just are asleep at the wheel and some that are actually helpful and actually know what they're looking at or want to know what they're looking at. I think as a founder, it's critical to know what your runway is, actually your runway will be, and who will invest in your next fund or what that next round looks like. Because if you get really low on runway, which I've seen, and you get down to maybe 6 months or 9 months or even 3 months of runway, and you're still burning money and you're still trying to grow, and your board maybe is tapped out and I'm not putting more money in this company, even in an emergency, like I have my ownership. I don't want any more ownership, like I'm done here, which is what's happening in a lot of companies now. And they'll go find outside investors or try to find outside investors, and they'll take their sweet time because they can. And they'll just let them bleed out, so to speak, especially if the metrics aren't perfect, which a lot of them aren't in a lot of companies now. And then they'll go try to sell the company without having any real cash in the bank. And the M&A, the real smart M&A people are saying, okay, yeah, let's kick some tires and we'll go for a test drive and we'll look over everything under the hood. And then they realize, okay, you're basically running out of money. I'm just going to, again, same thing. I'm going to let you run down to basically nothing. I'm going to give you a really predatory offer and your board's not going to want to do anything about it. And I'll get you for 10% of what you're worth. And I see a lot of that happening. I haven't had that happen in my portfolio really at all, because I will try to flag it. I have a couple of companies getting to that point, not many, thankfully, like two or three of a big portfolio. And I've told the founders repeatedly, you can't have this happen. Here's why. Here's what you do. Some have cut their burn dramatically and are raising bridge rounds, which are generally more or less committed small ones. One or two are flying closer to the sun than I'd like, but they're growing pretty fast, and I'm hopeful they'll be able to get financing. It's a tough market right now for a lot of founders, because especially the 20 and 21 companies, it's just, there's a lot of scar tissue out there, and it's hard to navigate through that, especially in the market conditions we're in right now.
And I think there's a tremendous amount of insight. Landscape has changed. We see similar patterns. Admittedly, though, I also see green shoots for businesses that are operating in AI, as you pointed out earlier. That said, my sense is that a lot of founders find raising capital the first time to be a bit enigmatic. I'd love to get or what advice would you give founders who are raising money for the first time?
Like a pre-seed round?
Yes.
Pre-seed's tough. A lot of it is who you know, who you can get in front of, and what story you can tell. And there are a lot of pre-seed investors now and seed investors, and it's ironically not a lot of A and B investors, which is why I'm pivoting in fund two to later stage for a lot of reasons. Quicker liquidity is one of them too. Pre-seed investors that are first-time founder, come from a second-tier city, maybe they went to a second-tier school, I would leverage the school network that you're a part of or were a part of, try to get investors that went to that school because there's at least some affinity there. I would 100% try to get warm introductions to other venture funds or angels or angel groups or sometimes family offices, although they're hard to get in front of the right ones. Having a warm introduction is something I definitely go after because I get a lot of cold emails. I want to respond to a lot of them and I want to talk to the founders. But I have 140 LPs between my two different funds. I don't even know how many companies at this point, 40 or 50 portfolio companies. I have a 6-month-old at home. I have a wife, which I still want to try to support, and my son. And there's all sorts of in-between stuff. There's new investments I'm making. So there's only so much bandwidth you have in a day. And a lot of VCs are in similar boats where it's like they have their own stakeholders that they have to manage too. And they have to pick the right investments. And there's only so much time of the day to diligence those investments and meet those founders and keep their networks alive, which like in my case, when I source a deal, I have 360 venture funds I work with across the country. Obviously, I don't talk to them all every day, every week, every month, and it'll vary pretty widely. But I have to keep that network warm to keep my deal flow going and the right kind of to get the right deals in there. So there's the deal flow, there's the diligence, there's the finding a new deal part, there's the supporting LPs and keeping them updated, helping portfolio companies and figuring out where they're going to go. There's everything under the spectrum, then their own personal life stuff with a newborn. So it's one of those things where if you get a cold email, it's probably just not going to get answered, or it's going to be bottom of the totem pole, so to speak, versus getting a warm introduction from someone that's already seen it, that's vetted it, from someone they know. You're much, much more likely to get something out of that conversation.
So said another way, don't underestimate the value of your existing network and just appreciate that if someone doesn't respond to you, it's not because they don't like you. Everyone's really busy. Appreciate you're going to need to be persistent and determined. And of course, I think this is inferred, the numbers need to be there. And so on that, what counsel would you give to founders just from like growth percentages? What are you looking for? Are there any minimum thresholds?
There's no official threshold and no fund's going to say they have a threshold, although a lot of them do. Pre-seed, it's going to have to be fast. Pre-seed, your base of revenue is small. So if you're at 50K in revenue or something, they may want to see you go to 400 or 500 next year. It's going to have to be quick. From pre-seed to seed, usually at least 2 to 3 or 4X year over year. I think from C to A, it'll obviously vary based on the industry and what you're spending and all sorts of different things. The general benchmark, I tell everyone below 3 to 5 in ARR is you generally need to be doubling every year at least. I think if you're over 5 in ARR, it depends on your burn and everything else, but aim to double at least 50, 60, 70% year over year. If you get below that, it can be hard to raise because a VC is going to look at that and be like, how are you going to get over 10 or 20 or 30 in ARR to get me the right exit, even smaller VCs? So you have to show that you can actually scale efficiently and get to where you need to be to get the right exit.
Said another way, there absolutely has to be an appreciation that whether you believe you've created the next best mousetrap or not, investors are absolutely going to be looking at your growth profile, depending on what stage of the business you are before making a decision, if they're even going to talk to you, let alone decide to cut a check. Scott, this has been an awesome conversation. Before we wrap up, one last question. What advice would you give your younger self if you were going to start all over again on your venture capital path?
From what age?
Say that again?
From what age?
Oh, no. So back when you, once you started Early Light and decided to create the company and take your first LP check.
A lot of things. I'd say fundraising is much harder than I thought it would be. I probably took 600 meetings to get fund one raised. Fund two was probably another 300 or 400. Fundraising is pretty brutal for a fund. It's just never ending. I'm still, my fund two is technically closed right now, and I'm still doing fundraising for fund three, which is 2 to 3 or 4 years down the road. Fundraising never stops. I wish I maybe knew that. From the admin side of things, running a fund is a lot more than I thought it would be. You have providers that obviously will help you with fund admin and accounting and things like that. I'm not doing K-1s for my investors. Our accounting firm is doing it. But there's a lot of things to get to that point where they're getting the K-1s. There's a lot of portfolio management involved, which I realized, but more than I think I thought there'd be. But a lot of it comes down to fundraising. I didn't think I realized how hard fundraising actually is in this region. There is money for funds. I'm just not sure there's money for smaller funds. And I think I underestimated the reality of you have to produce basically a 1x DPI in whatever fund you're in that they've invested in to get them to invest in the next fund. It doesn't matter how well it's shaping up versus the vintage. It doesn't matter if it's top quartile, top decile. It doesn't matter what your angel investment track record is. It could be 8 or 10x realized. It could be a 50, 60, 70% net IRR. It doesn't necessarily matter. It's, did they get all their money back? And do they think that there's actual upside in that for them to invest in the next fund? Not everyone, but a lot of the LPs want that, which is what I'm taking into consideration for fund three.
Scott, great conversation. I wish we had more time. Wealth of information. Thank you very much. Before we wrap up, if anyone wants to get a hold of you, founders, co-investors, LPs, how do they do that?
I really like VC.
There you go. Thank you, everybody, for tuning into another episode of the Innovators and Podcast. Super excited to have had Scott Garber, managing partner and founder of Early Life Ventures. Scott, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor, would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com/podcast-guest. If you've got something out of this interview, please share this episode on social media. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.